From the new Stanley and Dorothy Trolson Lecture Hall in Omaha's Durham Western Heritage Museum, Omaha Public Radio presents a special Black History Month program on Noon Forum. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Tuesday, February 5th, 2008, for broadcast at this time. We'll hear a Malcolm X Chautauqua performance with Charles Everett Pace, presenting an historical characterization of Malcolm X. Mr. Pace's appearance was sponsored by the Nebraska Humanities Council and presented as part of the Durham Western Heritage Museum's lecture series. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Western Heritage Museum, the Nebraska Humanities Council, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. This program contains material which may be offensive to some listeners. Here now to introduce the speaker is Harris Payne.
Our speaker today is Mr. Charles Everett Pace, a nationally recognized presenter. Mr. Pace will share his thoughts on the life and times of Malcolm X. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Charles Everett Pace.
Thank you, Mick.
Thank you, Mick, and good morning. Let me set up the program.
Nebraska Humanities Council. I've been touring the state of Nebraska for the last 18 years, all over the state, doing work for the Nebraska Humanities Council. Let me define the humanities for you. The humanities are those disciplines that we traditionally consider to be history, literature, philosophy, jurisprudence or law, religious studies, as well as my home discipline of anthropology, are principally concerned with asking the question, what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be Homo sapiens sapien on the planet Earth? That is always the question that we are investigating in a humanities program. And the type of program that I will do, we call it a Chautauqua performance. It always takes place in three parts. First, there is the presentation of the text. I will assume the persona of Malcolm X. I will do about 30 minutes worth of Malcolm. I will then break and take questions to Malcolm. And all the answers that I give you must be historically correct based on primary source material. So I call Chautauqua the cultural performance of scholarship. And then I'll break character and take questions to Charles Pace, the humanities scholar. And then I will answer questions that Malcolm could not or maybe would not answer. So when you listen to my oral text, I want you to listen to it in the same way that you read your written text in classes, that is, critically. Form little question marks in the margins of your mind. Take nothing at face value. And when I time to ask questions to Malcolm, probing questions, challenging questions, critical questions, because ultimately the essence of a democracy is an informed, challenging public. Only then can democracy survive. So we're going to watch this man who was born in Omaha, Nebraska, May 19, 1925, go through a series of life changes. We all go through changes. We'll look at three different men. And when we think about text in terms of dramatic theory, we say there are three ways you know a character. One, by what the character says. Two, by what others say about the character, and three, what the character does. Character is revealed through action. And so we're going to watch this man go through what we call an arc, a beginning, a middle, an end. And at the very end, I will reflect upon that arc. So let us assume that this is not 2008. But this is 1965, early 1965, January 1965. He really only has a few more weeks on this earth. And we are not in Omaha, but let's say we are in New York City. And let's say for a further leap of the imagination, we are all African American folk. And he comes out and he gives his typical Muslim greeting and two bodyguards on both sides. Serious, but Malcolm had a great deal of humor about him. I'll see if I can't personify some of that humor. And he gives his typical Muslim greeting of, "Assalamu alaikum." And during the few moments that we have left, we would just like to have an off-the-cuff chat between you and me. Us. We'd like to talk right down to earth in a language that everyone here can easily understand. We all agree. All of the speakers this afternoon have agreed that America has a very serious problem. And not only does America have a very serious problem, but our people have a very serious problem. America's problem is us. We are her problem. And the only reason that she has a problem is that she doesn't want us here. And every time you look at yourself, be you black, brown, red or yellow, a so-called Negro, you represent a person who poses such a serious problem for America simply because you're not wanted. Once we began to face this as a fact, we can begin to chart the course that will make us appear intelligent instead of unintelligent. Now, what you and I must learn to do is to forget our differences. When we come together, we don't come together as Baptists or Methodists. You don't catch hell because you are Baptist. You don't catch hell because you are Methodist. You don't catch hell because you are Baptist or a Methodist. You don't catch hell because you are Mason, a Democrat, a Republican, or an elk, and you sure don't catch hell because you're an American, because if you were an American, you wouldn't catch no hell. You catch hell because you're a black man. You catch hell, all of us catch hell for the same reason. So we all black people, so-called Negroes, second-class citizens, ex-slaves. You're nothing but an ex-slave. You don't like to be told that, but what else are you? You're an ex-slave. You didn't come here on the Mayflower. You were brought here in chains like a horse or a cow or a chicken. And you were brought here by the people who came over on the Mayflower. You were brought here by the pilgrims or so-called founding fathers. They were the ones who brought you here and shot you full of Novocaine. Like when you go to the dentist and he's going to take your tooth, what you do? You start fighting when he starts pulling. So to keep you from fighting back, they squirt some stuff in your jaw to call Novocaine to make you think they aren't doing anything to you. And because you got all of this Novocaine set up in you, you sit there and you suffer peacefully. Blood running all down your jaw, but you don't know what's happening, see, because somebody has taught you to suffer peacefully. Don't stop suffering. Just suffer peacefully. As Reverend Cleve pointed out, let your blood flow in the streets. This is a shame. And he's a Christian preacher. If it's a shame to him, you know what it is to me. There's nothing in our religious book, the Quran, as you call it, Koran, that teaches us to suffer peacefully. Our religion teaches us to be peaceful, obey the law, respect every man. But if someone puts his hands on you, send them to the cemetery. And that's a good religion. In fact, that's that old time religion. That's the one that Ma and Pa used to talk about. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth and a head for a head and a life for a life, and nobody,
Nobody resents that type of religion being taught except a wolf who intends to make you his next meal. And these old religious Uncle Toms running around here talking about give up your life for freedom? No, brothers and sisters, you preserve your life because it's the best thing you've got. And if you must give it up, I say if you must give it up, let it be even Stephen. My earliest recollection as a being snatched awake in the middle of the night because our house was on fire. My mother was a West Indian from Grenada, and my father, a militant Baptist minister and follower of Marcus Garvey, preached race pride and separation from the white man. The Lansing arm, that's Lansing Mission, of the Ku Klux Klan wanted him to stop preaching Garvey's message, but my father was not a frightened Negro, and he kept on. Next thing, he was found with his head bashed in, lying across the streetcar tracks. A trolley had almost cut him in half. After my father's death, my mother tried to hold the family together. She couldn't find work because the Christian people of Lansing wouldn't hire a widow of a crazy nigger. But she could stretch bread a dozen ways, fried bread and stewed bread, and when she found raisins, bread pudding. When there was no bread, she fed us dandelions, fried grass. We were so hungry, we were dizzy. We stole to stay alive. It was too much for her, so they put her away in a mental institution and parceled out us kids to reform schools, charities, and homes. When you live in a poor neighborhood, you are living in an area where you have poor schools. When you have poor schools, you have poor teachers. When you have poor teachers, you get a poor education. Poor education, you can only work on a poor paying job. And that poor paying job will enable you to live again in a poor neighborhood. So it's a very vicious cycle. I'll never forget the man who taught me English in the eighth grade. He told us that thing about what we wanted to do. I said, I wanted to become a lawyer. He said, you need to think about something you can do, like a carpenter. You got good grades, Malcolm, and people like you, but a lawyer is not a realistic goal for you, Malcolm, and you got to be realistic, Malcolm. You a nigger. In Roxbury in Boston, Mass., I got my first job at the Roseland Dance Hall shining shoes. And on the side, I sold liquor, reefers, and women. I got my first conk laid on. I got me a sharp zoot suit, and I used to jitterbug and party all day, and I stayed high all night. In fact, I got me a white chick, and I ran with the gamblers and the pimps. To stay out of the draft during World War II, I put on a show like I was crazy. I told the Army psychiatrist, I want to join. I want to join up. Yes, sir. I want to join the Japanese Army. I can't wait to get my hands on me some guns so I can shoot me up a lot of crackers. I got my 4F. New York was heaven, and Harlem was seventh heaven. 5 minutes on Lenox Avenue, and I had started on my life of crime. We often hear a lot of talk about the South. And we sometimes wonder why should we up here in Harlem worry about what happens in the South? Well, first of all, you got to realize that it's not really the South. South, As long as you south of the Canadian border, you south. If one room in your house is dirty, then you got a dirty house. If the kitchen is dirty, you got a dirty house. So don't be saying that this room is dirty, but the rest of my house is clean. You over the whole house. The entire house is under your jurisdiction. And the mistake that you and I make is letting these northern crackers shift away to the southern crackers. Now, I don't mean to be standing up here saying things that you didn't think I was going to say. But don't ever, ever call me up here to talk about the South. Because it's controlled right up here in the North. Alabama is controlled from the North. Mississippi is controlled from the North. These northern crackers are in cahoots with the southern crackers. Only these northern crackers will smile in your face and show their teeth, and they stick the knife in your back when you turn around. You at least know what that man down there is doing, and you know how to deal with him. So this is all I say. All I say is this. Whenever you start talking about the one, then talk about the other. Whenever you start worrying about the part or the piece, then worry about the whole. And if that part is no good and that piece is no good, then the whole pie is no good. Because it all comes from the same plate. It's all made up from the same ingredients. I was into everything the white police and gangsters left over for the black criminal. I was into numbers. Bootleg liquor, women, dope. I sold the bodies of white women to black men and black women to white men. I steered white people from downtown to whatever kind of sand they wanted in Harlem. And I'll tell you one thing. My best customers were always the officials, top police, businessmen, clergymen. Despite the fact that my own father was murdered by whites, I was sick enough to mix and socialize with them. In fact, I considered them to be gods and goddesses. I was caught when I was 21 and sentenced to 10 years in prison. That's when I first heard the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and they turned me around. Because there was something about the statement, the white man is the devil, that just clicked. It hit me like a blinding light, and I fell on my knees and pledged to Allah that I would tell the black man the true teachings of Islam and the white man the truth about his crimes. We also hear a lot of talk about Africa. East Africa, West Africa, North Africa, South Africa. And we sometimes wonder why should we, who have been separated from the African continent for 300 or 400 years, worry about what happens in Africa? Well, first of all, you got to realize that prior to 1954, Africa was controlled by the colonial powers. The colonial powers of Europe, having complete control over Africa, always projected the image of Africa how? Negatively. They always projected Africa as jungles, cannibals, nothing civilized. Why, then naturally it was so negative that it became negative to you and to me. And we began to hate it. And in hating Africa, and in hating things African, we ended up hating ourselves without even realizing it. Because you can't hate the roots of a tree and not hate the tree. You can't hate Africa and not hate yourself. Now you show me one of these brainwashed Negroes over here who has a negative attitude toward Africa, and I'll show you one who has a negative attitude toward himself. You can't have a positive attitude toward yourself and a negative attitude toward Africa at the same time. To the same degree that your understanding of and appreciation toward Africa becomes positive, You'll also find that your understanding of and appreciation toward yourself will also become positive, and this is what the white man knows. So they very skillfully make you and me hate our African features and our African characteristics, and you know yourself, we have been a people who have hated our African features. Oh, yes, we have. We hated our hair, hated our lips, hated our noses. We wanted one of them long dog-like noses, you know. And in hating Africa and hating the blood of Africa within our veins, we began to feel helpless. We began to feel inadequate. We began to feel as though it was holding us back. It wouldn't let us go this way or that way. And when we fell victim to this feeling of helplessness and inadequacy, we turned to someone else to show us the way. We didn't have confidence in black people or a black man to show us the way. In those days, we didn't. We didn't think that a black man could do anything except play some horn, you know, dribble a ball up and down a court. But in serious business where our food, our shelter, our education were concerned, we turned to the man. Why? Because we felt helpless. What made us feel helpless was our hatred for ourselves, and our hatred for ourselves stemmed from our hatred of things African. Yes, sir. Hodge? Well, I've always had the name El Hodge Shabazz, only I've only used it in the Muslim world. Well, Hodge is a name that's given to anyone who makes the pilgrimage to Mecca during the official Hajj season. At Jeddah in Saudi Arabia, I remembered the ancient words of Allah. To claim the pilgrimage among men, they will come on foot, and upon lean camel, they will come from every deep ravine. From Mecca, the holy city of Islam, I wrote to friends in America, never have I witnessed such sincere hospitality and true brotherhood as has been shown me here in this ancient holy city, the home of Abraham, Muhammad, and all of the other prophets from the Holy Scripture. You may be shocked at these words coming from me, but what I have seen has forced me to rearrange many of my previous convictions, to toss aside many of my conclusions previously held. For during the past 7 days, I have eaten from the same plate, drunk from the same cup, slept on the same rug, and prayed to the same God as fellow Muslims whose eyes were the bluest of blue, whose hair was the blondest of blonde, and whose skin was the whitest of white. We were truly the same, because their belief in one God has erased the whites from their mind, the white from their action, and the white from their attitude. Wearing the Ihram garb of a pilgrim, I made the 7 circuits around the Kaaba. I drank from the sacred wells of Zimzim and ran back and forth 7 times between the hills of Mount Al-Safa and Al-Manah. I stood on Mount Ararat and with my brothers proclaimed, I come, O Lord, in peace. And for the first time in my 39 years, I stood before the Creator of all and felt like a complete human being. Sincerely, El Hajj Malik El Shabazz, Malcolm X. Well, my going into the Muslim world, into the African world, and being accepted as an African and as a Muslim may have solved my problem personally, but I personally feel that my personal problem will never be solved until the plight of black people are solved, so I will remain Malcolm X As long as there's a need to struggle and protest and fight against the injustices that continue to plague black people in this country, now we will work with anyone, anywhere, nonviolently, as long as the enemy is nonviolent, but violent when the enemy gets violent. We'll work with you on your rent strikes. We'll work with you on your voter registration drives. And yes, sir, we'll even work with you on your school boycotts. Because now, I don't believe in any type of integration. Well, I don't believe in it because you're not going to get it nohow. See, you're not going to get it because you are afraid to die. And you've got to be willing to die if you try and force yourself on the white man. Because he will get just as violent as those crackers in Mississippi right here in Boston. But we are working with you because we are against a segregated school system. A segregated school system produces children who, when they graduate, graduate with crippled minds. But it doesn't mean necessarily that a school system is segregated because it's all black. Let me give an example. Look, the white man controls his own school system, his own economic system, his own political system, his own social system. But he also controls yours. And whenever you're under somebody else's control, you segregate it. Because they will always give you the worst or the lowest there is to offer. But it doesn't mean that you segregate it because you have your own. Just like the white man has control over his, you got to have control over yours. You know the best way to get rid of segregation? The white man is more afraid of separation than he is of integration. Now, segregation means he puts you away from him, but not so far away he doesn't have you totally within his power. Separation means that you're gone, and the white man will integrate faster than he will let you separate. So we work with you because we are against a segregated school system because it's criminal, because it's destructive in every way imaginable to the minds of the children who have to be exposed to that type of crippling education. Now, to understand this last point, you have to get back to what the young brother here referred to as the difference between the house Negro and the field Negro. You know, back during slavery, there were two types of Negroes. You had the house Negro, they lived in the house. And they ate the master's food when he left. But still, they lived near the master. And they loved the master more than the master loved himself. Master would come to that house Negro, he said, "Hey, Tom," he said, "we got a good house here." Old Tom said, "Yeah, boss," he said, "we got a good house here." Every time the master said "we," he said "we." That's how you can tell a house Negro. Master's house catch on fire, that house Negro would fight harder to put the blaze out than the master would. Master gets sick, that house Negro said, "What's the matter, boss? We sick? We sick." He identified with his master more than his master identified with himself. And if you come to that house Negro and you say, "Let's escape, let's run away," he'd look at you like you were crazy. "What you mean, escape from this good master? Where can I have a better house than I have here? Where can I have a better master than I have here? Where can I have better food than I have here?" That was that house Negro. Only back in them days, we call them something else. But there was another group of Negroes. That was field Negroes. See, there was always more Negroes in the fields than were Negroes in the house. Those Negroes in the house ate high up on the hog. Those Negroes in the field ate what was left from the insides of the hogs. They call them chitlins nowadays. Back then, they called them what they were, guts. That's what you were, gut eaters. Some of you are still gut eaters. And this field Negro was beaten from sun up to sundown, and he hated the master. I said he hated the master. He was intelligent. Master's house catch on fire, that field Negro didn't help put it out. He prayed for a wind, for a breeze. Master got sick, that field Negro hoped that he died. And if you come to that field, Negro, and you say, let's run away, let's escape, let's separate, he didn't say where we're going. He said any place is better than here. And you got some field Negroes in America today. The masses are field Negroes. I'm a field Negro. You don't see these little Negroes talking about our government is in trouble. They said the government is in trouble. Imagine a Negro talking about our government, our army, our navy. I even heard one say the other day, our astronauts. They won't even let him near the plant, but our astronauts. That's a Negro that is out of his mind. That's out of his mind. So in closing, I would just like to say that we all have the same goals, the same objectives. Freedom, justice, equality, and respect as human beings. We don't want to be integrationists, nor do we wish to be separationists. Just freedom, justice, equality, and respect as human beings. And in the racial climate of this country, it is anybody's guess which of these extremes and approach might meet a fatal catastrophic end first: nonviolent Dr. King, or so-called violent me. To think about dying really doesn't disturb me as it might some people. I've never really felt as though I would live to become an old man. My father and most of his brothers died by violence, my father because of what he believed in. And when you come right down to it and you take the kinds of things in which I believe, and you add to that the type of temperament that I have, plus the 100% dedication that I have to whatever I believe in, for these are ingredients which make it just about impossible for me to die of old age. I think it would be almost impossible to find anywhere in America a black man who's lived further down in the mud of human society than I've lived, or a black man who's been any more ignorant in his life than I have, or one who suffered any greater anguish than I have. But it is only after extreme grief that the greatest joy can come. It is only after experiencing darkness that the greatest appreciation of light, and it is only after slavery and prison that the greatest appreciation of freedom can come. And for the freedom of my 22 million black brothers and sisters, I do believe that I have struggled and fought the best that I know how, and the best that I could with the shortcomings I have, and my shortcomings are many. My greatest lack, I believe, is that I don't have the type of academic education I wish I had been able to get. To have been a lawyer, perhaps, I do believe that I would have made a good lawyer, as I've always loved verbal battle and challenge. And you can believe me that if I had the time, I would not be one bit ashamed to go back into any New York City public school and begin in the eighth grade where I left off, because I don't begin to be academically equipped for so many of the interests I have. For instance, I love languages. I don't know anything more frustrating than to be around someone speaking something you don't understand, especially when they are people who look just like you do. When I was in Africa, I heard original mother tongues such as Hausa and Swahili being spoken. And there I was, standing around like some little boy, waiting for someone to tell me what had been said. I'll never forget how ignorant I felt. Aside from the basic African dialects, I believe that I would study Chinese, because it looks as if Chinese would be the most powerful political language of the future, and already I have begun studying Arabic, which I believe will be the most powerful spiritual language of the future. I would just like to study. I mean ranging study, because I have a wide open mind and I'm interested in almost any subject you can mention. In fact, I know this is the reason why I've come to like, as individuals, some of the host of radio and television panel programs I've been on. People like Barry Farber and Barry Gray, Mike Wallace in New York, people like them. Because even if they have been in almost constant disagreement with me over the race issue, they've nevertheless managed to keep their minds open about certain truths that are happening in the world today. And they've also let me know they respected my mind in ways I know they never realized it. The way I know it is that often after a program, we would sit around the studio for an hour or so, and they would often invite my opinion over various issues. You see, most white men, even if they do credit a black man with some intelligence, still feels that the only issue that he's qualified to speak on is the race issue. You just notice how often you will ever hear a white man asking a black man, what do you think about the problems of world health or the race to put a man on the moon? Anyway, I live each day now as if I'm already dead. I say it like that because from the things that I know, I do not expect to live long enough to read my autobiography in its finished form. But when I am dead, I would just like for you to wait and see if I'm not right in what I say. That the white man in his press will make use of me dead just as he has made use of me while alive, as a convenient symbol of hatred. And this will help him to escape facing the truth that all I have been doing is holding up a mirror to reflect, to show the history of unspeakable crimes that his race has committed against my race. And yes, I have cherished my demagogue role. And I know that societies have often killed those who have helped to change those societies. But if I can die having brought any truth, having spread any ray of light that will help to destroy the racist cancer that is malignant in the body of America, then all the credit is due to Allah. Only the mistakes have been mine. And with that last sentence 2 weeks ago, I closed out my dictation of my autobiography to Mr. Alex Haley. It will come out sometime in the near future, but that's just a preview of what he had written about some time ago in Reader's Digest, and it will come out in autobiographical form. But this was not just to be a monologue from me to you. It was really to be a dialogue. So let me open this up for questions. If there are any questions that you have of me, Malcolm X, I'd be happy to take them. Any questions for Malcolm X? The question is, do I feel that former organization, indeed it is, it's affecting my life in many ways. Affecting my life psychologically and emotionally. I spent 12 years with that organization. It was headed and is headed by a man that I believed in more than he believed in himself. I was in prison. I was suffering the depth of degradation. In fact, I was so anti-everything in prison, they used to call me Satan. All I had known since the eighth grade after my father's died was a life of degradation, of a prison, of jail, of petty crime, of antisocial behavior. And this man saved my life. He did. And I joined him and I believed in him. But then again, I found out some things and recently found out some things that even I could not believe. And at that point, I had to make amends. I was ousted from that organization by a reason I won't get into. And now I find that I'm followed wherever I go. And that's why I say I don't think I will survive this year. And I have to say, if I was as ignorant and as blind as some of my brothers who are still in that organization, quite frankly, if I heard someone saying what I'm saying, I would kill me too. So I understand the mindset that they're under. And it's a dangerous thing to give your mind to some other person or some other organization, whether it's politically or whether it's philosophically or whether it's religiously. It can control your mind, and that's the state I was in. That's the state they're in. So, yes, physically, mentally, emotionally, my life is under a daily threat. Other questions? Question is, do I believe that Martin Luther King is right by being peaceful? Well, I think Dr. King is right for himself. I mean, I can respect his belief. I can respect his belief. I can respect his agreement that in keeping with the teaching of Christ that one should turn the other cheek. It's just that that's not my belief. I think, but more so than that, I think strategically and tactically I have problems with him, not just in terms of a personal belief. Each person has his own belief. But strategically and tactically, I think the idea of keeping the emphasis on civil rights is not the way to go. I think it should be raised to the level of human rights. You see, when you travel around the world and meet people, prime ministers and others in other countries, you realize as long as we're talking about human rights, that's something that is within the domestic sphere of the United States. So no other country is going to criticize that for being accused of interfering with the domestic affairs of America. They won't do that. But when you raise it to the level of human rights, see, the United Nations has something called the Universal Charter of Human Rights. Those are your God-given rights. Those are the rights that all civilized nations in the world agree to. And so when you raise it to the level of human rights and take it to the UN, then our brothers and sisters in Europe, our brothers and sisters in Asia, our brothers and sisters in Africa, our brothers and sisters in South and Central America can speak out on the abuse of our human rights in this country. That, I think, is a strategic and a tactical mistake. And finally, this idea of being peaceful for what? I'm going to get my head beat in so I can go to an integrated lunch counter, so I can have an integrated restroom. You know, I'm going to get my head beat up so I can sit next to a white man in the toilet. That just doesn't make any sense to me. But so far as he is concerned, sure, I can respect him for his way. That's just not my way. Question is, what religion was my parent and what made me want to be a Muslim? Well, my father was a Baptist minister. He's from Georgia. And I used to go to meetings with my father. But my father was also a member of another organization called, he was a Garveyite, a man from Jamaica by the name of Marcus Garvey came to this country when my father was a young man. And he had an organization called the Universal Negro Improvement Association. And this was an organization that talked about black men and women all over the world, Africa should unite, not just only politically, but also economically and culturally. And I saw these two ways of looking at the world. Well, when my father was killed and I moved away from anything like school and religion and civilization, and when I was in prison, my brother Reginald wrote me a letter. And he said, Malcolm, he said, what would you do if I could introduce you to a man who could get you out of prison? Well, see, I thought my brother was trying to run a game on the system. I didn't realize that the prison that he was talking about was a mental prison. I thought it was those physical bars. And when he told me about who this man was, and I began to listen to what he was saying, it began to make sense. And as I began to think about it, there was another man in prison by the name of Bimbi. Bimbi was the first man I'd ever seen, black man, who could command total attention just on the basis of his words. Even the white guards had to listen to Bimby. And Bimby said to me one day, he said, "You know, Malcolm," he said, "you got a brain." He said, it's a shame that you don't lose it, use it." And at that moment, I began to think. A white man by the name of Parkhurst had given his entire library to our prison. And I started to go to the library. And I got a dictionary, and I started with the very first word, and I worked my way all the way through. And I read philosophy, I read religion, I read history. I started to re-educate myself so that I felt worthy that I could write Mr. Muhammad and said I wanted to be a member of his organization. So it was that desire to improve myself to get out of the mental prison. And as I've related, I didn't realize I was becoming a part of another mental prison. But ultimately, it was desire to release myself from that mental prison. That's why I turned to Islam. One last question for Malcolm. Yes. Question is, if I got into a debate with Dr. King, what would be my key points and what is it that I think I would have to tell him? Well, one, as I said, rather than civil rights, I think it should be human rights. Two, I think we need to form a universal organization. I can appreciate his Southern Christian Leadership, which is a consortium of Christian ministers, but we need even a super organization. When I was in Africa, in Addis Ababa in Egypt, I sat at the table of Organization of African Unity. This was the meeting of all the African heads of states. This is why when I came back to this country, I formed the Organization of Afro-American Unity. I think this should be an umbrella organization that all the civil rights, so-called, and all the human rights and all the economic rights groups can be a part to. And we should sit down and talk shop with one another. And I would apologize to Dr. King of some of the things that I have said about him. I think this is a time of reconciliation, and I certainly want to do my part. I'm doing my part to change my image, and this is why I said you should be careful about the image that you construct of yourself, because the image that I built of myself can kill you sometime, and so it's every day I'm trying to change this image of me. That's what I would say. I do have to go and make another speech, so there's another scholar is going to come out for 5 minutes. So let me introduce Charles Pace, and he can ask questions that Malcolm could not answer for you. Any questions of me, Charles Pace?
Question is,
when Dr. King and Malcolm in the black community was assassinated, that left a void in the black community in terms of leadership. Whose job is it to step up? Yours, your job. We don't remember how young Malcolm and Dr. King was. They were only 39 years old when they were assassinated. On February 1st, 1960, when the modern civil rights in some area began, when four black students at North Carolina A&T set in at a Woolworth store. In 1955, when the Montgomery bus boycott happened, one of the things that Dr. King was severely criticized about was that he put the children, I mean elementary school children, on the front lines. They told him not to do that. He said, no, they are fighting for their freedom. They are part of this. When 1957, when Little Rock, which they just celebrated, I think, the 50th year, there were students in high school stepping up to the program. It is everybody's job to be a leader, to be a problem solver, to be a visionary, to be feel that you have a part to play in the society, in your particular community, in your particular family, among your friendship group. Not any one leader, for the very same reason that you said, they were assassinated. We live in that terrible time in the 60s when Jack Kennedy was assassinated, Bobby Kennedy was assassinated, Malcolm was assassinated, Meggie Evers was assassinated, Ahmaud was assassinated, and any number of other people were assassinated that didn't have the larger news. But it's not true that there were no longer leaders. There were always leaders, and there have always been leaders. They just didn't get the headlines that the other got. Ultimately, leadership has to be local. And whose job is it? It's all of our job to be visionaries and to understand what the goal is. Out of many, one. Out of many, one. That's the American creed. We all have the goal of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and it's all of our job, what we would call the social contract, that we would do what we need to do to ensure that all of us has that. That's whose job it is. Yes, sir. Question is, do I think the Black Panther Party misrepresented the philosophy of Malcolm X after his death? I don't know if I would say misrepresented, but I get your point. They saw themselves as the continuation of the philosophy of Malcolm X. I think more than anything, the Black Panther Party themselves were misrepresented in the same way that Malcolm talked about the press. When I think about the Black Panther Party, all you saw was people with guns. But they had guns because they said it's our right to have guns, but they also had a law book. And we hear this phrase of the Panthers of black power, and that's all that was projected. But that wasn't the Panther chant. The Panther chant was power, power, power to the people. All power to the people. All power to all people. Black power to black people. Red power to red people. White power to white people. Black power to black people. Power, power to the people. All power to the people. All power to all people. That was the chant of the Panthers. But that's not what you heard over the media. So I wouldn't say that they misrepresented Malcolm's philosophy. I think they really created their own philosophy, though they saw themselves as the continuation organizationally of the ideology of Malcolm X. Now, after saying that, like many organizations, any number of things starts to happen, and that pure ideology starts to be corrupted. And you start to get criminal elements, and that ideal that you started with starts to change for any number of reasons as humans. One is that they started to be shot down, and so therefore even the law book aspect of the Panther started to take a secondary position by the way the system reacted to the Panthers. So that has to be seen also in a cultural context. Yes. Why do I think I'm able to speak on behalf of Malcolm X? Well, you know, when I was growing up, I would come home from school and I would turn to Walter Cronkite, or I would turn to any of the number of people, and I would see Malcolm being interviewed, and I was just blown away by this man. I mean, his intelligence, his command of the camera. We didn't have that term back in those days, but sound bites. Malcolm could say more in one sentence than most people could say, you know, in a whole dialogue. But then when I read the text, you got to read the text. When I read the words of Malcolm, I started to understand what his words were about. And let me end with a reference to that, because it's about time for you to go. You got 4 minutes. I call this Malcolm, Pilgrim in Search of a Common Humanity. This is my statement about Malcolm X. When the man known as Malcolm X was assassinated on 21 February, 1965, a physically young yet spiritually complete life was brought to an all too early abrupt end. In his brief 39 eventful years, Malcolm had achieved a degree of wholeness in his life that few humans of any age are fortunate enough to experience. He was a man who had confronted and transcended three major rites of passage, a rite which led from his ego through his ethnic into a global sense of his human potential. He had obtained a pan-human state of political spiritual growth. Malcolm X stated during his last days that he had come to champion that which is good for humanity as a whole. As a young street hustler, Malcolm Little had been concerned primarily about the satisfaction of his personal carnal pleasures, his ego needs and desires. After his prison sentencing of 10 years for petty criminal activity, he was forced to reflect upon the quality of his life. He joined the Nation of Islam, black Muslims, under the leadership of Elijah Muhammad. And upon his release from prison, as a reward for his superb organizing and speaking abilities, Muhammad appointed Malcolm to the post of national minister. From this involvement, Malcolm developed a deeper sense of his ethnic responsibility to teach and awaken what he called the brainwashed black masses. Finally, in the wake of his ouster from the Nation, acceptance of Orthodox Islam, he was a Sunni, and conversion experience in Mecca, Malcolm was forced into an encounter with his wider global self. He toured several African and Middle Eastern countries, often as the personal guest of prime ministers and presidents. This series of mind-expanding encounters convinced Malcolm that American white racism was not genetically determined, as he had formerly believed, but rather socially constructed. The significance of this discovery was that he came to see that radical socio-political, i.e. structural change within American society could cure it of his 300-year-old racist tradition. His writings and speeches provide a record of the growth and development of a constantly evolving mind. The autobiography of Malcolm X is now an American cultural classic. It documents a life of struggle, change, and triumph. Thus, it is not a tragedy, but rather a living testament of hope. Now, after four decades after his death, his words serve as a stimulant for new thought. It is a rich legacy for the rest of us to explore through history, film, anthropology, literature, visual arts, poetry, music, dance, theater, courses and seminars in a variety of settings, American studies at its best. This is what it is to me, at any rate. Over the past 30 years, I have spoken his words and analyzed his life with audiences from Texas to Tanzania, from South Dakota to South Africa, and from Old England to New England. There is an African saying which asserts, to speak a dead man's name and words is to make him live again. I speak, thus X lives. Enough said. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
You've been listening to a special program on Noon Forum. We've heard a Malcolm X Chautauqua performance with Charles Everett Pace, presenting an historical characterization of Malcolm X. Mr. Pace's appearance was sponsored by the Nebraska Humanities Council and presented as part of the Durham Western Heritage Museum's lecture series. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Tuesday, February 5th, 2008, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Shauna Forsberg, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Western Heritage Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.